Welcome to
The Curiosity of
Playing Cards Part 2.
Yeah, so let's get on with this. So this episode,
we take a peek at the Devil's Picture Books.
I look at how Thomas Delery transformed printing and playing cards.
And we head to the Wild West to meet a mystic namesake of mine.
That's right, and actually Anton's on the tail end of a cold, which he's given to me, so I'm on the whatever the opposite of a tail end is of
basically,
a cold.
Basically, we've both got colds, so that's why we either sound weird, sniff a lot, or cough a lot.
Yes.
Hopefully a lot of that will be edited out, though.
Oh, well, I'm a fine editor now, which I'm about to demonstrate. As you know, we haven't had a theme tune.
We
check
haven't had a theme tune
this
yet.
Out. Are you ready? I think you'll like this. Done. Podcast.
Just stop.
Honestly. Okay. Okay, no good? No. Okay, should we get on with
Let's just not put that in.
Let's get on with the episode. So after our chat with the brilliant Lee Asher, we wanted to cover a few more things about magic that we uncovered in our research. So if you've not heard the interview, make sure that you go back and check it out before listening to this episode. It was a really interesting and inspiring chat with Lee, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He's really passionate about magic and playing card history. And he had some great advice, I think, for you on performing and, like, critically learning from your mistakes. So I discovered a book by a lady called Miss May King van Rensselaer, who is also the author of the hit 1882 book Crochet, Lace, Etc. I mean, I'm sure that's a bestseller, that one. And in 1890, she published another book, by the title The Devil's Picture Books, and it was a history of playing cards. So when I saw that name, I was really intrigued, thinking, oh, what sort of history are we going to have in here? Particularly from the late 1800s, I thought maybe there'd be some odd tales or stories or things in there, and difference of opinion to what we have today. Miss Rensselaer, she was actually a very serious lady, and on the 3rd of January 1917, the New York Times ran an article about her exploding a verbal bomb at the Historical Society's annual meeting.
Oh, goodness.
I know. I've got a quote here, which has been recorded by Bree from Pontifax.
I have been attending the meetings of the New York Historical Society for nearly 3 years and have not heard one new or advanced scientific thought, although many distinguished scholars have visited the city. Having been a life member of the society, I can no longer be silent on the conditions which exist in an organization of which I should be proud, but of which I am ashamed. I hear on all sides that the society is dead or moribund. Instead of being in the front rank of similar organizations in the United States, it is in the rear. Some members may be satisfied with present conditions. I am not. Many have told me they have resigned because of them. Only a few attend meetings because they are uninteresting and dull. And instead of an imposing edifice filled with treasures from old New York, what do we find? Only a deformed monstrosity filled with curiosities, ill-arranged and badly assorted. And we ought to have another committee to rearrange the collections and enlarge them properly.
That's a pretty damning quote there, isn't it?
Yeah.
So she was actually seems to be a very clever and a serious lady, and she needed to be. So I'm sure her lace work and croquet was fantastic.
Croquet.
Crochet. She probably played croquet too.
No.
Anyway, yeah, so those are strong words. But what can she tell us about playing cards, and is the devil involved? Do you know where playing cards originated?
No.
No, okay. That's good. That's why you're here today. So the exact origins are unknown. And over time, like, people's ideas or opinions or understanding has changed. And what we see as playing cards today, which you love and collect, isn't how they've always looked. That's when we chatted to Lee, he mentioned some of that as well, didn't he? So long before the cards, we had cards of any form in Europe, they were actually being used in Asia. And China may lay claim to producing the earliest ancestors of today's cards. And some early accounts include one from the Qingzu Tong, which was a Chinese encyclopedia from 1678. And it states that cards were invented around the 1120s during the Song Dynasty. And they were as an amusement for the emperor's concubines. And maybe a more reliable account there comes from 1320 in a legal compilation called the Dan Yang Xing Zeng Gu Chao Dian Zhang.
Otherwise known as the Dan Yang Xing Zeng Gu Chao Dian Zhang.
Thank you. And it reports a case from the 17th of July 1294, in which two gamblers were arrested along with the wooden printing blocks that they were using for creating cards.
So they arrested the printing blocks. It's like when they arrested a coconut. That happened at some point somewhere in the world. I remember that.
And pigs were put on trial as well. Yeah. No, they didn't arrest the printing blocks, just the people, and they confiscated the printing blocks and the paper along with them. Because, like, as the story of cards throughout history, like, gambling has always been part of it, and playing games, and people try to crack down at different times. So the fact that the authorities were cracking down on this means that they must have actually been using cards for a while for it to become, like, distributed enough to become a big problem.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so there's a picture here of some early cards, and you can actually see kind of a hint there, can't you, at cards today?
That'll be in the show notes, I imagine.
Yeah, it will be. So what can you see on those?
People.
Uh-huh.
A few different symbols, like, there's a fish on one of them. Then on other ones, there seems to be coins. So that seems like the counting, the one, the ace, the two, the like three, all the numbers.
Yeah.
And yeah, some writing as well.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. So in like at school, in primary school, we had some Mandarin lessons and they showed us some numbers. And I think there's numbers on the cards. Like, you see the lines?
Uh-huh.
I think those are numbers. There we go.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually. Because there's always been, like, a numerical component to cards. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you'll notice the shape there is very different. So they're very long and thin, aren't they?
Like a bookmark.
Yeah, like a bookmark, exactly. Yeah, and that meant they could be fanned out really easy in the hand. So they're good for playing games, or maybe you had quite a few cards in your hand.
Next, we're off to India, another possible origin of playing cards. We should really be using the time machine for this.
We should be.
It's a bit dusty, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It needs a service.
Yeah. We'll have to go back in time to get the service because they don't do it anymore.
Ooh, that's...
paradox.
That's dangerous, yeah.
Anyway, chess was invented in India in the 6th century. There were many similar games played on checkered boards. Some of these used round discs, beautifully decorated with images of people and animals instead of figures.
I may have some pictures in the show notes. They're great, aren't they?
They look like coins, sort of, fancy coloured. It's like if you had a coin but had all the colours and everything on it, I guess.
Uh-huh, or nice placemats.
Oh, drinks. Yeah, like a coaster. Yeah.
Coaster, that's it, yeah.
They were used in a game called Ganjifa, which is derived from the Farsi word Ganjife, which means playing cards. Mrs. Rensselaer wrote in her book...
Okay, we don't have a quote for this one, so I will have to try and do the voice... They are painted on ivory and the backs are gilded. They are numbered the same as tarot cards. This pack contains 7 suits, which are suns, moons, crowns, cushions, harps, letters and swords. I'm not doing an impression of Brie here, by the way.
No.
No.
You're not even doing an impression of anyone.
No. Of each of these suits, there are 10 numeral cards and 2 court cards, which appear to represent a sovereign and a general.
These may not look like our modern day cards in shape and material, but the arrangement into suits, like we use now, is closer.
We'll probably never know exactly what the origins of playing cards are, and there probably wasn't a single one. It's what we have today is a collection and amalgamation of many ideas and games from different cultures, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But how did they reach Europe? I mean, did Marco Polo pick them up on his travels in China?
Prisoners, maybe. Or the Silk Road.
Yeah, you could have them coming down the Silk Road. Yeah, that makes sense. So there's a lot of trade there. And with the Phoenicians as well, they would be trading with Arabic traders. And Italy was a really important centre of printing as well. So you could have, if you've got Phoenician traders coming in and there's like printing facilities around there and they've just got these cards and these games, you could see the locals wanting to print them there. And one possible theory or idea is that they came via Egypt and the Mamluks in the 14 and 1500s. Now, I've got an image here, which will also be in the show notes, of some absolutely beautiful cards. They're lovely, aren't they?
They look like bookmarks again, though, but they look nice.
They're covered in intricate hand-drawn and painted patterns, which are really typical of Islamic art. And there's rich blues and golds and wonderful hand-painted floral images and geometric shapes on them. And whilst they're probably more detailed than the typical pack that you'll think of today, the style...
Not quite, because I think the back design of a lot of cards have a lot of detail like this still.
This is the front, though.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's the front.
Yeah, so forget about the Kickstarter ones that are really elaborate.
And these are hand-painted, I imagine.
Yes, yes, they are. They're also quite big, because they are 25 by 14 and a half centimetres.
That is quite big.
So you can see that maybe the games being played or their uses is a little bit different to what we had today.
Maybe they're more decorative. Or like something that you own, potentially.
Yeah, well, maybe, yeah, they were used perhaps in the royal court or something. And yeah, they were luxury items that people owned. Can you tell what suit this is?
Coins.
Like cups.
Where? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was looking at the round things.
Yeah, they also had coins, though. And scimitars, which are a type of sword. And they had polo sticks. Mm-hmm. So not what we have today, but they are divided into four suits of 13 cards each, which gives a total of?
A number.
13 times 4?
52.
Well done.
Yay!
Yes, which is how many cards do you have in a deck today, excluding Jokers?
52.
Yes.
Whenever we're recording the podcast, we always do bad maths, but when we're just doing it normally, we're actually quite good.
It's the pressure. I'm trying to think of the what's going on. So they have the cards 1 to 10, then they have a second lieutenant, a lieutenant, I said that to annoy Granny, and a king. But the court cards, they're not pictorial, and instead the ranks are actually written on them. Because in Islamic art, you don't have imagery of people. But that's not the only writing on the cards. They also have rhyming aphorisms, which they don't rhyme in the translation, unfortunately. But there's a couple here. With the sword of happiness, I shall redeem a beloved who will afterwards take my life. Look at how wonderful my game is and my dress extraordinarily beautiful. I will, as pearls on a string, be lifted in the hands of kings. So quite pretty kind of phrases, those. Would you want those on your cards today?
No, because I like clean designs.
With the Mamluks, Sultanate controlling like Egypt and parts of the Levant, there was naturally contact and trade with Europe and then the spread of ideas. And many consider these Mamluk cards to be the ancestors of modern European cards, and I think they're really beautiful. And another way that Muslim playing cards may have entered Europe was via the Moors in southern and central Spain. Do you remember last time I put a towel on the table in front of you when we recorded?
Oh yeah, and had a rabbit in it.
Yeah, and a knife. Okay, so that towel isn't for your tears.
If you don't understand the context of that, go back and listen to the episode, because that's a bit ominous.
Yeah. So can you open up the towel, please? And what do you find inside? Is it another knife?
No, it's a Moorish deck of playing cards. Let's just do some quick ASMR.
Anton is now opening the deck next to the microphone. Whilst he struggles with opening that deck, what you have in front of you there, or in your hands, is the recreation of a very important deck of cards. Now, these probably date from around 1420, and they were actually found as an uncut sheet of cards, so they were never actually completed.
That means that they've used those printing techniques, though, where they put it all on a sheet.
Which is obviously perfect for mass production and also consistency of the design. But the ones that you've got there, they may actually be a Christian copy of the original designs. She had a lot of mixed cultures in Spain. Anton has now cut into the cellophane surrounding the cards. He's carefully sitting back down.
I'm back.
He's back. His headphones are going on.
half our listenership are loving this, the other half are hating it.
Yeah. And the other half are a bit confused.
Yeah, all three halves.
That's how you get the listens.
Nice.
Okay, anyway.
So can you tell what suits are on those cards?
That looks like coins.
Uh-huh, yeah.
We might have some photos.
Yeah, we'll do some photos.
That's definitely swords.
Yeah.
Cups?
Yeah.
And whatever those are.
And whatever those are. So you've got swords, cups, discs or coins, and what is either a curved club or possibly a horn or something. Not exactly sure what it is. And they're basically simpler versions of the Mamluk designs. So there's a side-by-side here, and you can see how the inspirations come across, can't you?
Mm-hmm.
But they are much simpler. So why are these cards so important? It's because they actually bridge the gap between Arabic cards and European cards. And that deck is actually the only known deck discovered that bridges this particular part. So they're really important in the history of playing cards.
Yeah, because without these, that would have been even more of a mystery of how they got to Europe.
Ah, yeah. You can even trace maybe a line back to the Chinese cards on these as well, because you've got like a sword shape emblem going all the way through them, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
So there's some Chinese cards through to Arabic and through to Italian. I'm going to have this picture in the show notes so you can see. And speaking of which, I believe that you have some European history of playing cards, don't you?
Yeah. So we'll have our pictures for some reference in the show notes of the cards that we've just got. And on our Patreon, we might take some other like super amazing pictures, because I want to do that.
Okay.
Of these cards and some other ones as well.
Yes.
This is a nice thing for them. Okay. There are limited references to playing cards prior to the 1370s in European writings, but suddenly there are accounts from Belgium, Germany, Spain and Italy when other games are mentioned. We have already looked at how they entered Spain, but Italy was another important entry point. The combination of Venetian traders and Italy being a centre of printing led to their production and distribution. And it seems they spread quickly, with some of the earliest records talking about how they and other games were banned. Too much gambling. In 1377, a Swiss Dominican friar wrote of a game comprising of four seated kings, each one holding a certain sign in their hand. Each king would have two moscali cards under them, and 10 more cards with numbered pips, 1 to 10, totalling 52 cards.
Yes, I think the Marciali must be like Marshall and like the Knight or the Knave.
Yeah. There were other packs described with 5 or 6 kings of different suits or containing queens. What's interesting is these cards show human imagery, so must have been produced in Europe, and their manufacture and use must have been spreading. So if Islamic culture don't show the human imagery,
uh-huh,
they show other things. There's another reference from Italy.
In the year 1379, there was brought to Verbo a game of cards in which the Saracen language is called Nieb. So it's a card game.
Mm-hmm. The written references to cards spread and become more common, with different places banning them or taxing their sale. So they would tax the aces on cards. So you could get a deck of cards, but if you wanted the ace or the spades or whatever, you'd have to get it like stamped or something and officially taxed and paid for.
Ah, that's interesting. So when I was reading about Thomas Delary, which we'll cover a little bit later, there was a mention of him having to go and get, I think it was getting the cards registered or something, so for tax reasons.
But it wasn't just a game for peasants. In 1392, King Charles VI of France, I swear he's a peasant. Oh, okay, never mind. Paid 56 sols parisis for 3 packs of gilded cards for his amusement. Do you know what Edward IV banned from being imported to England in 1463?
Llamas.
No. Playing cards, dice, and tennis balls, obviously.
Ah.
He did this to protect English craftsmen.
So is that protecting English manufacturers from cheaper imports, or is it protecting them from playing too many games?
Yes. The cards didn't yet have the familiar hearts, diamonds, spades and clubs, though. Hearts arrived in a French deck from 1480 that showed hearts and crescent moons, which portrayed their Arabic origins.
That's interesting. So, yeah, the symbols are starting to morph then.
But distinct regional suits were beginning to appear. Spanish and Italian decks kept their strong Mamluk and Moorish influences with swords and cups, common. But the German cards had acorns, birds, bells, flowers, hearts, hunting equipment as well. Which sounded a lot cooler than our cards now. But it was Le French who first standardised hearts, diamonds, spades and clubs in the late 15th century. A benefit of these was only two different colours were needed to identify them, simplifying the printing process. And they were simple shapes as well to print too. The French suits and style of cards would then spread throughout Europe and globally, becoming the most commonly used today. The different suits have different meanings as well. Hearts. Hearts typically symbolise emotions, love and moral, spiritual or religious core of a person.
Yeah, and some historical interpretations of hearts being linked to the clergy, representing virtue and the moral force of the human spirit.
Whereas diamonds are often associated with wealth, material riches or the merchant class. They might also represent clarity, invincibility and purity, reflecting the properties of the gemstone.
That's right, and they have been suggested to symbolise the merchant class or the societal focus on wealth, material prosperity.
Clubs are thought to represent the peasantry or common folk, possibly symbolising growth, nature or the agricultural realm, giving their resemblance to a clover or a tree.
Mm. And historically, they might have symbolised the working class or military, considering the club or clover could be seen as a kergel or a symbol of force.
Do you mean a cudgel?
A cudgel.
Not a kergel.
Yeah, I can't read. Could have been seen as a cudgel or a symbol of force.
Spades are often associated with the military, warfare or the aristocracy. They might symbolise the mind, intelligence or death, given their pointed shape and resemblance to a spearhead or a leaf.
They're sometimes interpreted to represent the nobility or military, symbolising power, strength and the inevitability of death. So do you have a favourite? Which one would you be?
Probably spades.
So what's your opinion on the standardisation of these suits? You just said earlier that the German ones seem more exciting.
I prefer German ones. If they could be printed in a slightly simplified way, then I think that'd be good.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a shame that the French ones have become so common. Thank you, Anton. I think it's time for a local link. Now, do you remember our episode about Warren Delarue, the man who looked at the sun?
Yep. If our listeners don't, or are just listening to this episode, go to episode 33.
Yes, and do you remember what business he was in?
Printing.
That's right, yeah. And what company did his dad set up?
Delarue Printing.
Pretty much, yeah. Delarue & Co. Okay, yeah, so we've got a little bit about his dad here, who is a very important printer. Now, some of the cards that you have, particularly your ones from Kickstarter, they've got like amazing foiling and embossing and UV ink and all sorts, don't they? Mm-hmm. But Thomas Delarue, Warren's dad, he could actually be one of the men responsible for the incredible cards that we have today. Now, he was born over here in Guernsey in 1793, but in 1818 he moved to London to make straw hats. But thankfully he didn't stick with that for very long and moved into bookbinding and paper manufacturing printing. And his company, Delarue & Co., they were not ordinary printers because they actually produced like stamps and passports and money. And this is stuff that needs really, really serious printing, so it demands like the highest level standards, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And in 1831, he filed a patent for certain improvements in making or manufacturing and ornamenting playing cards. So, something special, dare I say magical, was about to happen.
Foreshadowing.
And his patent was a big deal. Not only for playing cards, but for colour printing in general. And in it, he detailed many improvements, such as creating better quality oil colours and the enamelling of cards. And with his experience, cards went from basic woodblock printing on flimsy cards, which were coloured by hand and watercolour and stenciled, to much more modern letterpress and colour printing technologies. And here's an extract from his instructions.
Take 1 gallon of old linseed oil, the older the better, and boil it very slowly for 3 or 4 hours in an iron pot or vessel, occasionally igniting it and stirring it during the whole process with an iron ladle. In some instances, I find it necessary to dip a few slices of stale bread just prior to ebullition taking place, which facilitates the operation. When it is cold, it should be the consistency of very thick treacle.
Thank you, Anton. Or was that Thomas himself?
No, because I doubt he sounded had that accent if it's from Guernsey.
Do you think he ate the bread?
Yes.
Now, one of the difficulties with printing several colours is ensuring that the plates are in registration. So that means all the colours are lining up when you print it on a bit of paper. And Thomas solved this problem several years before it was patented by a man called Godfrey Engelmann Mulhouse. In his printing facilities, he would even use steam power. So he was properly embracing the Industrial Revolution. So Thomas Delery basically invented modern colour printing, and his son invented the first proper light bulb. I mean, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So check out our episode on Warren for that. And here's a few of his early designs. What do you think of them? And what do you notice about the king?
I like them. They have big eyes. I like the little line in the pip. And the king of hearts, otherwise known as the suicide king, is stabbing himself in the head with a sword. Well, basically, what happened is... I think originally, this is one of the ideas. Originally, they were holding an axe or something like that. And because it got drawn so badly before printing and everything, it eventually just turned into a sword that was in the king's head, pretty much.
Yeah, so it gets nicknamed the Suicide King. So there's a bit of personality in the faces there, aren't there? Mm-hmm. And that's something that Thomas Delery wanted to try and do. But there's a really famous card player around at the time called Mrs. Battle. And her name was appropriate, and she didn't like the designs at all, and she made sure that was known. But they didn't put Thomas off innovating, and in 1844, he began a 20-year collaboration with a designer called Owen Jones. I bet he's Welsh, with a name like that. Until this point, playing cards had generally had really plain backs, but this would show any dirt or marks and make the cards really identifiable when you're playing games. So he commissioned Owen to create ornate images and patterns for the card backs. And many of them are floral, and they actually hark back in a way to the old Mamluk cards. And there's a couple of things written about the cards here. Mr. Delery's idea had been to excite and cultivate the public taste. In these more elegant forms of printing, formerly in England, few or no manufacturers had thought of going to the expense of employing designers. And even Charles Dickens himself wrote about Thomas Delery's playing cards. Can you do a Dickens impression?
Yes. Each card back forms a dainty little picture worthy of being regarded as such, irrespective of the main purpose of the card.
That was uncanny. It was like Dickens was here.
Okay, those pictures.
Yes, these are the card backs. But you can see how they've got some of the hints of the Mamluk ones.
Yeah, I don't like them.
No, they're of their era, definitely. I think they're a little bit gaudy, some of them. But where Thomas was quite clever, he even designed some, not with two different colours, like red and black, for the pips. He did a 4-colour one to help people with poor eyesight identify each card. So there's a lot of thought going there. Mm-hmm. And there's lots more that we could talk about Thomas Delery, but we're not going to. So that might be a whole episode in itself as another...
Guernsey great!
Yes.
Which we came up with.
We did. We were there first.
Yeah. You know who you are.
Oh, wow.
We're joking.
We are joking, yes.
But we did come up with it first.
Yeah, you came up with that.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Like 3 years ago? Something like that.
Must be, yeah. God, it's been going a long time, this podcast. And we're still very amateur.
Still got to do. Yeah.
Anyway, something I love about cards is that whilst their designs have changed, the basic premise and fundamentals of them hasn't altered that much for maybe hundreds or thousands of years. And like Lee said when we chatted to him, like, how many other things do you have in your house that have changed so little since your grandparents might have played with them in the same way at your age?
Because they're just perfectly done.
Yeah.
But still customizable, like with card backs and everything.
Yeah, they're small, they're pocketable, they're, once mass production came in, it's cheap to produce. And there's a quote here from William Chatto in his 1848 Facts and Speculations About Playing Cards. No other game has been ever so generally played by people of both sexes, young, old, rich and poor. It is perhaps as extensively diffused as the use of tobacco and is certainly indulged in by a greater variety of persons. You're not really interested in playing games with cards, are you? You're more interested in the magic that can be performed by them, aren't you?
Yes.
And that's something else that I love as well, because for me, I like the idea that there might be like this amazing trick performed today that leaves me really mystified and astounded and entertained. And maybe that same trick was being performed by a magician maybe a couple of hundred years ago and left his audience with the same feeling.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lovely idea. So how about we end with a magician? Actually, how about we end with a completely new feature? Time for a famous Anton.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's ominous.
That's right. We're doing a feature on myself, the famous Anton magician. Good golly gosh.
You could do a feature on our Patreon.
Yes, actually. Yes. If you would like to hear our other magician, go over to Patreon, subscribe to, I imagine, our $1 one. You'll get that, the rest of this episode, and some more rewards as well. So
yes.
Go over there. That is what... Just go on to Patreon, yeah. The Curiosity of, or The Curiosity of the Child.
You're just desperate to get people to sign up, aren't you?
No, I just think it's quite cool.
Yeah, it's quite cool. Actually, it's very cool.
Especially if they do it, so do it.
Yeah, anyway, so, here's Anton the Showman. You are a bit like Pinelli, who will be the feature of our Patreon episode.
Yeah.
Okay, so we are going to talk about Anton Zamlok, a.k.a. Professor Zamlok, a.k.a. Zamlok the Great! So what would your stage name be?
Anton the Great, with my beautiful assistant, Father the Little.
Thank you. I hope you're going to ask what my stage name was.
I was wondering at you pointing at you. What's your stage name going to be?
I think I'll be the Rictator, and my amazing mentalism powers are used to astound the audience and then take over the country.
Huh.
Yeah. Anyway... Back to Anton Zamlok. He was born in Austria in the mid-1800s, and he got his first taste of magic as a young boy when a magician, Ignaz Kaitner, toured the village he lived in. Now, Zamlok, he actually lived in a Slovenian-speaking region, and the magician only knew German, so he wanted one of the local lads to help him out. And after an afternoon of training, Anton was tasked with hiding under a table and passing items up to Kaitner. And from this, his love of magic was born. And actually said he never saw the amazement of watching a show. His first interaction with magic was understanding how it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Which you've spoken to me before about how you see magic different now.
That would be a weird way to get introduced to it. You'd understand it not as like, how did that happen? But like, oh, that's cool how they came up with this illusion.
Yeah.
Rather than how do they do that illusion?
Yeah. Yeah, seeing it from the other side. But his mother was quite worried that he had sold his soul to the devil.
At like 4 years old.
Yeah. Then a few years later, when he was called up for an army examination in his mid-teens, he actually threatened that he would run away. So to avoid embarrassment, his dad packed him off to his uncle who lived in San Francisco. And his love of magic... It hadn't died, and a few years later, when he was working as a printer, he decided to print thousands of handbills, which read,
"Amusing and mysterious. Zamlok, the great Austrian wizard from the Imperial Court of Vienna, and his series of new and marvellous wonders, etc."
Etc., yes. So, looking at that, it seems like a lot of magicians like to...
Make
big statements.
Up.
Yeah, yeah. He would write later of this, like the beginning of his time as a magician... "I will never forget the day when Carter brought them from the printing office. I hastily broke into the package to open them up and have a look. It was the first time I saw my name in print, and I have to say I was very proud," putting it mildly. Sorry to any of our German or Austrian listeners there. So he decided to go on tour. with a couple of his friends and become a magician in America, and basically start touring around the Wild West and going into places like Utah and the city of Park City. And every new town that he would arrive in, he would seek out the theatre and where to perform. So in this case, the theatre owner asked Zamlok what sort of show he had. And when he answered magic, the owner said,
"Yee-haw! Well, my friend, go back to where you came from. This town ain't big enough for the..." Oh, no, never mind.
"Well, my friend, go back to where you came from. This town isn't partial to that kind of shows. The rent is $10, but you ain't making 50 cents.
Very Wild West."
Thank you. So they had a bit of a negotiation, and Zamlok managed to get him down to only $5, and he would even promise to pay in advance. And then he managed to fill the theatre, as so many people wanted to watch. So much so that the local silver miners, they actually brought in extra benches to put at the back of the theatre so that they could all watch. And as he continued touring around the Wild West, he also tells this story of another trick that he performed. "I did a trick in which I got a boy to come on stage and pretend to give him a lesson in juggling. I take a dinner plate and do different stunts with it, and finish by spinning it on the tip of my finger, after which I insist the boy try it too. He attempts to spin it on his finger and of course drops it, and the plate breaks into many pieces. I pretend to be angry at the boy and scold him for his awkwardness. I compel him to pick up the pieces and wrap them in newspaper. I then put the parcel into a box and place the box on the boy's head. Billy," now Billy's his brother-in-law, "takes a picture frame in his hand and stands behind the boy, and I shoot the pieces out of the box into the picture frame." So this is a gun shooting at the boy's head. Okay. Or a box on the boy's head.
Good. I was going to say, if it's anything else.
At the report of the gun, the plate instantly appears inside the frame, and now the boy opens the box and finds it empty. But taking a second look at the plate, I discover a piece is missing. I ask the boy if whether he was sure he picked up all the pieces. He, of course, says that he did. I then accuse him of keeping one piece and hiding it from me. He denies it. By this time, the boy is getting very angry. I accuse him of having the piece in his pocket and tell him to search his pockets. He does so, very reluctantly, and to his astonishment, he finds the missing piece in his pocket. I pretend to scold him more severely for hiding the piece. By this time, he is ready to fight.
So you held him at gunpoint and stop him from fighting. They will sit down and watch the rest of the show.
Well, I next place the piece into a large-mouthed pistol and fire at the plate, which instantly becomes whole and perfectly restored. Then Billy takes it out of its frame and lays it on the table. At the finish of this, I say to the audience, "If any of you have broken glass or crockeryware, send it here tomorrow, and I will mend it." And, of course, believing that anybody of any intelligence would know that I was joking. But he discovered that the next morning, there were three girls came to him holding packages of, like, broken kitchenware and glass and things, with the wishes from their mothers to have them fixed. So he had to say to them that, unfortunately, they had already packed away the pistol and he couldn't do it. And you can see... Yeah, there's a photo of him. There's a real twinkle in his eye, isn't there? Mm-hmm. You know he's mischievous. I think he actually wrote some memoirs, but I don't think they've been published, which is a shame. They offer an amazing window on the Mormons in Utah at the time. And it talk about different times where he'd be sleeping on floors as he's travelling in like an outhouse, and there'd be like a foot of onions next to him. And it'd be really cold, and he'd go and want to wash in the morning, and then the person who owns the barn or whatever, say, "Oh, there's a pump over there, but it'd be freezing cold." There'd be another, like, Widow McIntosh, who he remembers really dearly, because when he was travelling, she goes, "Oh, if I'd known some gentleman would be coming, I would have put on a great feast for you," but she cooked, like, the most amazing meal anyway. Yeah. But she's kept apologising. There's another time where he would often go to the newspapers before he performed. So he went to one of the local newspapers in the area and he performs his tricks, and then they see his tricks and he gets free advertising because they want to write about him. And he made a box of cigars vanish, and they nearly shot him for banditry. But with all of his amazing shows that he put on, he would go on to become one of the greatest magicians of the age. And some people actually said he was the greatest magician of the age. And there's a great little quote here from the Oakland Tribune of 1879. "The continued success which Zamlok the magician has met at the Diaz Opera House this week is almost unprecedented in the history of public entertainments given in Oakland. His extravagances of magic were so swiftly executed and so mysteriously subtle that 2 centuries ago he could have been burned at the stake as a necromancer of the blackest of arts and a disciple of his satanic majesty. But in the age of Anno Domini 1879, he is a pleasant gentleman and a harmless entertainer. The world does move on. I think his shows sound really good. I reckon it'd be quite popular today.
Mm-hmm. Especially with the plate trick.
Yeah, it's really good. He did another one where he would make an omelette in the top hat of somebody from the audience. They'd mix it all up and then he would hand the hat back in perfect condition, nice and clean.
He seems like a comedy magician as well.
Yes, that actually says on one of his posters that there's comedy and stuff there. It feels really modern to me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, with that egg trick, he would have his bumbling assistant, who was his brother-in-law, Billy. He would copy the trick, trying to expose how it was done. So he'd break the eggs in the hat of another person from the audience, and then he would end up smearing like egg yolk and white all around it. And then he would say, oh, no, I've forgotten how to finish the trick. And he'd give the hat back.
It's like when people would say, like, oh, can I borrow your watch? Can I borrow your credit card? They do the trick, the watch disappears, and they just walk off saying, and then they're like, then they get told to come back and then they just say, oh no, I just forgot how to do the rest of the trick.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously the watch is just in their pocket or something though. Or like back on the wrist of the person, that'd be good.
But he actually wrecked these hats though. He ruined them. Yeah. So he even did it once to a local governor in Canada. Then in another trick, Billy, his brother-in-law, would clumsily knock over all the equipment that was on the stage and it would reveal Zamlock's secrets. So I'm not quite sure how he'd do this, but what I read was that he would stuff his brother-in-law into a double-barrel shotgun. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you fit a person to that, so maybe a big sort of comical one, I don't know.
Yeah.
And he'd fire at a target, then all that would be left of the man was a wart. He'd do other things, like he would trick kids into thinking that he'd cut their noses off. And apparently it was really realistic. So I don't know if he had fake blood and things as well. Or other times he would get like a guy from the audience who was really shy and he'd say, oh, can you hold this case of jewels for me? And then later on, I guess he left him awkwardly standing on the stage for a while, I hope so. When he opened up the case again, it'd have a lady's corset in. So it'd be like really embarrassing for the guy on the stage. Yeah, so one of his posters said, enjoy yourself while you live, for you will be dead a long time. So I like his humour. It's really good. So I think he's a bit of a legend. I mean, for me, he's like the ace of spades of magicians.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of him?
I think he's quite funny. I wish that he was a bit more known about. And he seems to be quite a comedy magician with effects that are like flabbergasting, but also funny.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so many stories of him. I'd love to find his memoirs. Anything else you want to say, mate?
Well, I have a magic trick.
Ooh, okay. I'm ready.
Which might work. All right, listeners, I have a challenge for you. Bit of a magic trick as well. I want you to think of the first playing card that comes to your head. Just the first, straight away. Keep that in your head. Draw a picture. And I want you to write us a message on either Twitter or X, which you can find us at.
At CuriousTyofAChild Pod. Yeah, or go to our website where you can find all our contact details, thecuriousityofachild.com.
Yep.
And let us know what card you thought of.
And if you're on Patreon, I think you can write a message to us on there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so send us that. And once you've done that, I think your cards would have been either the Ace of Spades or the Queen of Hearts. Was that your card?
That was my card. I was thinking of the Ace of Hearts.
That's not how it works.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, so a bit of magic there. So if Anton did guess your card correctly, please write to us and let us know, because we love hearing from our listeners.
If not, then don't write to us, because that probably didn't work. But if only people who it did work for write to us, then it seemed like it did work. A big thank you to Bree from Pontifax for reading Mrs. Rensurly at the start of the episode. Go check out the excellently named Pontifax podcast at pontifax.podbean.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's play their trailer.
Hello, I'm Fry.
And I'm Bree from Pontifax, a papal history podcast ranking all of the popes from Peter to Francis.
In each episode, we explore the life of a single pope and contextualize their papacy in world history.
And then we rate them based on the success of their papacy, how scandalous they were, their impact on the secular world, what their face looked like, and more. They may even pick up a new patron sainthood on the way.
In the end, our most impactful papal bull-worthy popes will battle it out for the keys to the pearly gates and to be the popiest pope who ever poped.
You can find Pontifex at pontifex.podbean.com or wherever you find your podcasts. And on the Agora Podcast Network.
And you could pick up a patron sainthood by becoming a patron.
For them or for us.
Yes. Yeah, they're lovely. So you should definitely go listen to their podcast. It's really good.
Mm-hmm. I need to listen to that.
Yes.
I'm still trying to finish Totalis Rancium at the moment.
And I'm still waiting for you to get through to the final episode so I can listen to it.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, thank you for listening. So what do you think, Anton? Any summary on playing cards and history and what you think of them?
I like playing cards because you can design them in cool ways. I think they've evolved quite a lot, but not like in a super drastic way compared to other things that have evolved, like humans. So they've always sort of been paper cards more often than not. And they've had their suits, but even the suits have changed and little things like that. And there's so many different customizable ways you can make cards.
Mm-hmm. What I like, and just thinking when we chatted to Lee Asher as well, and how there is something special about magic and that trickery, and that it is something physical. So you could see in 100 years' time, if everything's starting to go more and more digital, is magic going to hold an even more special place, like something in the real, actual world that can still deceive you or trick you? I think it might get an even more special quality. Yeah. And like, you show me a lot of your magic tricks you do as you're learning and practicing, and there's still things there like, wow, have you done that? It's really cool. And yeah, so they're amazing little things.
Hmm.
Yeah, so thank you very much for listening, and we will be back with another episode with possibly another famous Anton, as I think I'm going to try and find a famous Anton for everything we talk about from now on.
Yeah, that'll be the new segment.
Yeah,
that could be like our Patreon extras, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, speaking of which, if you can't wait until our next episode, which might be a while, depends how busy we are, then go over to our Patreon again. Subscribe again.
Yeah, patreon.com/QHRpod.
Yeah, something along those lines. Also, we found a good thing for our site episode, so we'll do a short little extra on that, another Anton thing. So go over to see what that is.
Yeah, and you can follow us on Twix, which is Twitter X, at
CureCharPod.
Also on Instagram at
CureCharPod.
Our website is
thecuriosityofchild.com.
Yeah. And yeah, so thank you very much for listening, and we will be back soon. Please leave a review or something somewhere as well, because podcasts live or die by their reviews, and independent podcasts like us need support. Thank
yes.
you. Goodbye, and we love you.
Only if you subscribe to Patreon.
Wow. That's so you can buy more cards, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that we can get more nice things for our listeners as well.
Yes.
Also, we do have some merchandise as well. Shop.
Oh, we do have merchandise. Yeah. Oh my god.
Let me say that again. shop.thecuriouswitchhard.com.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Anton's crying.
Yeah, because I'm ill.
You okay, mate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not your words. They're not that beautiful.